see innovation, but then I don't believe that regulation is necessarily the enemy of innovation. But I don't think they've yet found the holy grail. A lot of it is about stability, consistency, long-term thinking, all of which, of course, we haven't had over the last few years with chipping and changing of R&D tax credits, for instance. So we know what the principles are. The big question is, how do you make sure that people adopt standards that incorporate those principles? And I'm afraid the government has been pretty timid about that.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTN podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. I am your host, Jane Wakefield, and this week I am joined by Lord Timothy Clement Jones, a Liberal Democrat peer and spokesman for the digital economy in the House of Lords. Welcome, Tim. Can I call you Tim or should I call you Lord Clement Jones?
I think you better call me Tim, Jane, okay. Otherwise people will start getting worried.
Well, welcome to the podcast. Now, before we get into sort of the nitty-gritty of tech policy, I just wanted to ask you, you know, you're a spokesperson for the digital economy. Tech startups and scale-ups play a vital role in the UK's digital economy, many of whom will be our listeners. So how would you say that governments go about creating the conditions that allow those sort of companies to flourish?
It's quite complex. I mean, when you look at what you need to do to create the right culture, it's a mixture. It's obviously getting university researched, commercialized. So it means having strong clusters, if you like, of university research. It means having the right commercialization, which is the catapults. It means having the right R&D incentives in the tax system. It means having the right finance available in terms of de-risking some of that early stage startup financing, maybe through things like British Business Bank. But it's, you know, a lot of people have looked at this, and obviously they've looked at inward direct investment as well, you know, viz the Harrington report. But I don't think they've yet found the holy grail. A lot of it is about stability, consistency, long-term thinking, all of which, of course, we haven't had over the last few years with chipping and changing of R&D tax credits, for instance. You know, the climate for universities has not been a kind one in the research area because of the horizon issues. So, you know, you could say that the context has been quite a difficult one, which has contributed to a lack of, I mean, we have had lower investment between 21 and 22. And obviously, we all want to create the stable conditions to make sure that we get those startup conditions right.
And you mentioned the chopping and changing there. I mean, that's just sort of the nature of politics, isn't it? And we're coming up to a year where we could see change once again. Do you think that, you know, from what you've seen of Labour policies, if we do have a Labour government, that they will get it right? And let's talk a little bit about Lib Dem policies on tech.
I don't think Labour's policy has yet fully emerged, but I do quite like what I hear from Rachel Reeves about the long term in terms of forward planning. You know, they're talking about a 10-year time horizon. So is Peter Kyle, their shadow DCIT Secretary of State. And they're also talking about making sure that you can distinguish between revenue expenditure and capital expenditure. Now, you know, that is a holy grail again of what governments have been about, but nobody's ever yet succeeded in doing that in a proper fashion. But I do hope that we can do that. And when you say that all chopping and changing is in the nature of politics, it's not in the nature of politics that you have four prime ministers in 5 years. we've had a particularly turbulent period. And when you look back, I dare say, when the Lib Dems were in coalition with the Tories, you know, how many chancellors did we have? One. How many secretaries of state for business did we have? One. How many home secretaries did we have? One. So we didn't have that chopping and changing. We had an enormous amount of stability. And then, of course, we ruined it all by having Brexit happen. So, you know, in a way, I look back with some nostalgia on that period.
And let's talk. I mean, people have stopped talking about Brexit. I think they've had enough of it, right? But we do need to think about it in particular when it comes to sort of tech startups and the sort of tech economy. What's your feeling on how it's kind of affected things? Has it really set us back, or are we able to sort of carry on as normal?
I think the digital world, which is what we're really talking about, the tech economy, I think we're just about okay, actually, because we've got that data adequacy between ourselves and Europe, and the tech economy relies to a huge extent on the free transfer of data between ourselves and the EU, and having the right conditions in place with the states as well. What would be absolutely horrendous is if we put that at risk, basically. That would be a real problem. But I also think that Brexit has damaged business confidence. We have fallen back in terms of the growth that we otherwise would have had, in my view. So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. I think it's very difficult, specifically to the tech economy, apart from things like Horizon, where there was a clear impact on university research and our ability to, in a sense, get moving with startups and so on. But I would say that the threats all come down the line at the moment.
And of course, the government is well aware of the sort of wider threats of technology. You know, we've seen these companies grow up out of Silicon Valley and bring huge benefits to society, but we're now sort of reaping some of the sort of more negative sides of the tech economy. And I'm talking about sort of social media. I'm talking about artificial intelligence. And I feel as if the government is now trying to really get to grips with that, thinking about regulation. We've got the huge Online Safety Act, which tries to encompass pretty much every aspect of technology. Some would say it struggles to do so. What are your thoughts on that act? Because it was a very ambitious piece of legislation, wasn't it? And it's got an awful lot of, it covers an awful lot of bases.
Yeah, and my goodness me, it took a sweat to get it over the line, basically. It took 5 years at least from the original green paper. And so I think we were behind the curve. We're behind Europe in terms of legislating on that front. But we did get it through. And I'm confident that Ofcom will do a good job in terms of producing the codes. I think there was an enormous amount of cross-party agreement on what we needed to do. And, you know, both ourselves and Labour absolutely made sure that we were right there, saying, look, we want to cooperate. We want to make sure this is an all-party effort to get this bill through. And we did. Now, there are some things that I do regret. I think that there are certain things that we could have done better on in terms of legal but harmful, as it's loosely called. But, you know, I'm not going to quibble. And we're already, you know, people before it even come into effect are already starting to wonder whether it's comprehensive enough. You know, when you look at all the deep fake aspects and so on and so forth, and kick the tires and say, does it really cover this and cover that? In fact, it covers a surprising amount, but it's social media. You know, it's not AI specific legislation. You know, we've got to recognize that. It does cover the functionalities of social media, but that's not the same as covering all the aspects of, for instance, the creation of deep fakes where social media isn't necessarily involved.
And we'll talk about AI in a sec, but you mentioned there that, you know, it hasn't yet sort of started to properly kick in. How confident are you that Ofcom is going to be able to cope with being in charge of regulating this enormous area and getting that right? And you know, basically, the legislation was just the start of it, right? Now the real work starts.
I know, that's the funny thing. You know, as politicians, you labour in the vineyard, and then you know, the act happens and your first instinct is to say, oh, well, that's done and dusted. But of course, it's not. All the work now is with Ofcom, and many of us are tracking their consultation on the different codes that they're producing, you know, for instance, on illegal arms and so on and so forth. But I'm pretty confident. I mean, we wouldn't have been happy with the designation of Ofcom as a regulator unless we had some confidence in it. They took on, you know, something like 300 more people to cope with this. They've developed skills through the Digital Regulators Cooperation Forum specific to things like algorithmic amplification and so on. So I do think that actually when the time comes and the codes come into effect, that this will have an impact. And of course, it's always going to be a question of whether the social media behemoths actually respond, you know, or whether we're going to find ourselves in all kinds of regulatory activity with judicial review and all that kind of aspect.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been reporting on regulation of tech for many years, and it does feel that a lot of the stuff the EU attempted to do, whilst very good and very earnest, did get caught up in exactly that, you know, appeals. And eventually, you know, a little bit of money was paid out. Well, a lot of money, but for these big tech companies, not really that big a deal. And then they just carried on the same. So I guess we just have to see whether it will be the same here or not.
Well, absolutely. And that's why we've had all the arguments on the digital markets bill as well, over whether it's JR or its merits, the kind of ability of big tech to take court action to overturn the decisions of another regulator, the Competition and Markets Authority. So, you know, that's been quite a big argument. And that argument isn't over yet. We voted in the Lords to go back to a formulation before the government changed it in response to pressure from big tech that was there at the beginning of the bill. And we hope that that will stick, but I don't have a great deal of confidence that it will.
HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Now, you mentioned as well artificial intelligence, and of course, you're the co-chairman of the all-party parliamentary group on AI. You also mentioned that the government, you know, has maybe fallen behind with the Online Safety Act. Do you think it's trying to get ahead of the AI debate? It was one of the first to hold a big summit to look at the issues. What are your thoughts around how it's regulating AI?
I'm afraid I think we're behind the curve. We had a very, very good debate on Friday on a private member's bill that Lord Holmes of Richmond has put forward. And, you know, Chris was part of my select committee originally when I chaired the AI, the House of Lords AI Select Committee between 2017-2018. And he's, you know, long been an advocate for proper regulation. And he put forward some, I thought, pretty, you know, uncontroversial propositions in the private member's bill, you know, not going as far as even as I would want to go. But the government, you know, were pretty negative about that. They are pretty negative generally about anything other than the kind of voluntary adoption by the regulators of a set of principles, which we all know what they are. They're the OECD ethical principles, the G20 principles that have been, you know, enunciated in various government papers, you know, the original AI strategy, the white paper last year, the consultation this year. So we know what the principles are. The big question is, how do you make sure that people adopt standards that incorporate those principles? And I'm afraid the government has been pretty timid about that. And their motives for being so timid, I don't know, because they talk at length and did before the Bletchley Park summit about existential risk. We've got an AI Safety Institute, which talks about the risks of AI in respect of safety. And yet we don't have any proposal for regulation. But I do recommend having a look-see at that debate. It just to see where the battle lines are drawn, basically, because we all want to see innovation. But then I don't believe that regulation is necessarily the enemy of innovation. I think it can create certainty, consistency, and then you try and get convergence on standards internationally to make sure that your developers and adopters know what the rules of the road are, even if they operate in different jurisdictions.
So where would you regulate then? Because this is an incredibly complex area, isn't it? We've got, you know, on the one hand, the issue of big tech once again dominating this burgeoning kind of technology. We've also got issues around copyright and already seeing people complaining about the use of their data to train these AI models. Then we've got the sort of wider societal issue of whether of deep fakes and whether anything we see or read can be believed or not. So just of those three issues, what do you think we have to focus on, or do we have to look at them all, and we have to, and how do we sort of really get to grips with it?
Well, I can tick them off. Copyright, the general belief, especially in the creative industries, is that ingestion of copyrighted material into a large language model that is then used to output various versions of the original, that is subject to UK copyright law. There is no text and data mining exemption. And so that should be recognised. It should be, there should be a licence taken if you ingest material in the UK from copyrighted material. It should be transparent that you have done. There should be an obligation of transparency. And that, funny enough, is a clause in Lord Holmes's bill, which is quite useful. But the broader aspect in terms of regulation is relatively straightforward. It's not like social media, where you have to be really careful about the freedom of expression aspect. This is about the functionality of deep neural networks. And this is about making sure that you're mitigating the harm. So what you're trying to do is to say, right, well, there's going to be a standard that you have to adopt for testing, a standard you have to adopt for auditing, a standard you have to adopt for risk assessment, an impact assessment, and a standard you adopt for continuous monitoring. That's the kind of suite of standards, if you like. They're already beginning to be out there, certainly in risk management and testing and so on, and ethical design. You know, there are standards out there from the ISO, from IEEE, from the states in terms of the National Institute for Standards and Technology. So what you would do, you would make it mandatory to adopt those standards. And those standards by themselves incorporate the ethical principles. And so it's relatively straightforward to envisage something of that sort. And then, of course, what you're doing at the same time is making sure that those international standards become really important, so people place emphasis on them right across, whether it's in the EU or the States or whatever, which means that effectively you're getting the ability of our developers and adopters to not find barriers, if you like, when they operate internationally. In terms of deep fakes, this is the most intractable issue, and people are beginning to think about watermarking. They're beginning to think about election, and we've been advocating election rules for this for some time, but the government have resisted on that front. But the deep fake aspect, and of course, you know, that's going to become more and more prevalent. And we've seen Keir Starmer have an audio deep fake. We've seen the Czech president have a video deep fake. We've seen Joe Biden have a video deep fake, I think. So and this year of elections, I think we're going to see more, and they're going to be used to make mischief. So for my money, that is the most difficult one. And it's where, strangely enough, governments seem as passive as in the other areas.
Difficult, but impossible. I mean, what can be done now? Because as you say, we're entering a new sort of era of not being able to trust anything we see or hear. And whilst, you know, it's easy to sort of put a watermark on something, that's still not necessarily going to stop people from believing what they're seeing, is it? You know, they might doubt that. They're, you know, there's many, many layers to this debate, as we've seen in recent kind of weeks around the crisis in the royals with photos. People will believe what they want to believe. So it's almost an education issue here, isn't it? Rather than anything that we can done technically.
There is a big issue around digital literacy so that people can spot this stuff. But actually, and funny you should say it, because I've got an amendment coming up to the data protection bill that would mean that if a system was, in a sense, collaborating in outputting a deep fake from its AI abilities, if you like, that would be contrary to the data protection bill. And there's another one that relates to pornography. There are various suggestions for trying to control the level of deep fakery. And some of them are applying to the developers. Some of them are applying to those who actually create them using a generative AI tool. So, you know, it pays money to take your choice, but we will be debating those before the end of the bill. And the government could easily pick up one of them if it felt that they hit the button. But I fear that they probably won't, actually. You know, the process of making regulations or legislation in this area, you know, is too slow.
And then we have the issue you mentioned with Ofcom. You know, they had to employ 300 more staff. If you're asking for a set of standards, they will need to be assessed by a standards board. Do we even have the kind of, is there even in existence a board that could take on that job when it comes to AI? Do we even have the skills to get people up to scratch to understand what it is they're sort of assessing?
Well, we've got the British Standards Institute, actually, which is our existing standard setter. And the point is, you'd have to adopt an accredited set of standards, and people like the BSI produce those standards. So I don't think that whole aspect is overcomplicated in terms of, for my money, I would make the regulator of AI for this purpose, who would make sure that these various sets of standards were adopted. I'd make that the ICO. I mean, the government have talked about setting up this new central body, which we don't quite know what it is. We don't know where it would have its being. But for my money, I would build on the existing regulator. I mean, AI, to a huge extent, is data. So the ICO is quite well positioned to take on that role. And then what they would simply do is, with the legislation that I'm suggesting, they would make sure that the high-risk applications had to adopt these standards. And, you know, what we actually need is a bunch of professionals who assist corporates in meeting those standards. Now, that's a different ball game. And I think, you know, we need to think about who the appropriate profession are in order to do that. Are they privacy professionals? Are they IT people? Are they chief technology officers? You know, we have to build a profession, in a sense, of people who can do that. But again, I think people are going to volunteer for that.
Now, you mentioned earlier about election interference. And as we're recording this, there is a lot of activity in government around cyber attacks accessing the data of millions of UK voters and the cyber attacks being linked to China. Now, another of your hats, you wear many, is deputy chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on China. So I obviously wanted to get your thoughts on what's going on with cyber attacks and our voting data.
Well, colleagues of mine have just come back who are on the All-Party Group, including the chair, Richard Graham, MP, and you know, they've just come back from China, and the All Party China Group is basically about relationships with China, but essentially what we want to make sure is that Britain benefits from our relationship. And Richard made it very clear when he was in China what our views were about things like hacking and so on. So we're not there as an apologist for China to do these things. And I think it's really dangerous if countries hack into each other's social media and texts and so on and so forth. And it's no wonder that people have a belief that encryption needs to stay, you know, and that's why, of course, people worry about their privacy. But, you know, we rely on people at the National Cybersecurity Center to keep us safe. And that was one of the best things that's been done during the last few years. And I have some confidence that they know what they're up to, but they have to be vigilant the whole time.
It does feel, though, as I was reading today, that the golden age of relations with China is completely come to an end. Obviously, we've seen infrastructure bans on grounds of national security, removal of Chinese companies from infrastructure plans, that even a chip factory in Wales was forced to sell because of its links to China. So we really are very in the weeds of geopolitics now, aren't we, when it comes to tech development?
Yes, I'm afraid that's very true. And, you know, Peter Mandelson in a column in the Sunday Times yesterday talked about the changing of supply chains. And he's right. I mean, people are more averse now to creating a supply chain that starts in China, which is sad. I was part of the optimist during that golden age when David Cameron was prime minister. And of course, it's slightly ironic that he's now foreign secretary in the age where it's all turned rather sour. But I do regret that. And I think that this is just what's happened. And we are now increasingly falling back on supply chains that are in the West. But that puts even greater pressure on us to make sure we get those common standards. Because, you know, we probably can't produce as cheaply, but what we have to do is try and make sure that the market is a common one between us in terms of standards.
It's not just supply chains, though, is it? And infrastructure, it's kind of companies like TikTok, which are one of the most popular social media platforms on the planet. What are your thoughts on what's going on in the US re TikTok?
I think that's a quite an overreaction, actually. I mean, look, there are lots of things to react to about in TikTok, you know, if there's harmful material or whatever, which, you know, they claim that they take down and so on and so forth. But I really don't believe that because they're owned by ByteDance that they're going to be a kind of global threat in that sense. I think that's a US overreaction. And we don't have that approach to them in the UK, I'm glad to say. But we are considerably more, I was going to use the word paranoid, but I don't think actually it's necessarily paranoid. I think it does represent a reality nowadays. We are concerned about the nature of this kind of activity, of this kind of cyber activity, you know, and of course it can include industrial espionage as well.
Now we're coming towards the end. And I wanted to end on a sort of more positive note because we've looked at a lot of the issues, but let's talk a bit more positively. What is it that you're most excited about when it comes to technology?
Oh, I think in terms of productivity, things like AI can do a fantastic amount of good. You know, I think we can help solve things like the sustainable development goals. You know, it can increase our yields. It can help us decide where the best place to grow things is, so where we can have the best agriculture. We can discover patterns of poverty that need eradicating. AI is fantastic at discovering patterns. Things like generative AI that can increase our productivity in the workplace enormously and make our jobs more fulfilling. But of course, we have to get the balance right so that, you know, AI is not just a substitutional technology, and the average corporate doesn't simply say, well, I can get rid of all my PAs and all my clerks or whatever it happens to be, you know, or administrators. We have to get a balance in all of this and consciously try and create fulfilling jobs by using new technology. And I think AI, unusually for technology, does raise a lot of ethical problems. I think that's why I think it's different to previous technologies, that it does raise these ethical issues because it does kind of strike at what is humanity, if you like, and what is machine. And we have to, you know, make sure that humanity has a role, a continuing role.
Now, here's a question to finish with. You mentioned generative AI there. Do you think any politician has yet used ChatGPT or one of its equivalents to write their speeches?
I think they quoted, but I hope that the principle of transparency continues so that when people do have a speech written by AI, they say it was written by AI. I did a dinner in the Commons recently and asked it to make me a speech congratulating Sir Peter Bottomley, and it gave a beautiful couple of sentences. I did tell people that it was ChatGPT or GPT-4 that had created it.
Well, I'm glad that there's still some honesty in Parliament. That was fascinating chat. Thank you, Lord Clement Jones, for joining me. But that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of the UKTM podcast. We will be back with another episode next week. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, goodbye from me. This podcast is brought to you by HSBC Innovation Banking, the power behind the UK's forward thinkers, future makers, and leap takers. They're helping to ignite the bold ideas that reshape our world. Go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb to find out how innovation needs different.